right, and I see that we are ready to proceed with the next case. It is Maria Teresa Pupo versus the Commissioner of Social Security. Joseph Teplicki is here for Ms. Pupo, along with Catherine Palacios Paredes, and Shannon Fischel is here for the Commissioner. And Mr. Teplicki, you may proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, Your Honor. I'm Joseph Teplicki for the claimant. I will be addressing the appellant's argument one, dealing with the borderline age situation. My co-counsel, Catherine Palacios, will be addressing all the other arguments. The issue presented here, simply stated, is whether or not the administration is free to ignore a command in the Social Security regulation. In the case presently before this court, the claimant was 2 months and 5 days away from attaining the age of 55 when the ALJ issued the decision on her case. The ALJ found in his notice of decision that the claimant has no past relevant work, that she's not able to communicate in English, and is considered in the same way as an individual who is illiterate in English, which meant that she had education and history with the most adversity that a claimant could have had at the time. Thus, pursuant to the SSA Medication Vocational Guidelines, also known as the GRID rules, if she would have been treated as a 55-year-old individual, a finding of disabled would have been directed. However, because she was not yet actually 55 years of age, the ALJ did not treat her as being age 55, and thus her case was not approved. Regulation 416.963 says, if you're within a few days to a few months of reaching an older age category, and using the older age category would result in a determination or a decision that you are disabled, we will consider whether to use the older age category after evaluating the overall impact of all the factors in your case. This is the whole key to the case because it mandates the ALJ to consider whether to use the older age category, which the ALJ in this case never did. This is further made clear in SSA's internal policy manual, known as the HALIS, which says that if a borderline age situation exists, the ALJ must decide whether it is appropriate to use the claimant's chronological age or the higher age category. This is HALIS I-2-2-42. I stress the word must is in the HALIS. The HALIS then goes on to state that the ALJ will explain in the decision that he or she considered the borderline age situation, state whether he or she applied the higher age category or the chronological age, and note the specific factors he or she considered. The HALIS explains that the ALJ will take a sliding scale approach when determining which age category to use, meaning a claimant should be more likely to be put into the higher age category the closer she is to crossing the borderline age. The HALIS goes on to explain.
Mr. Teplicki, let's assume that you're correct, but the commissioner says that even if the ALJ erred by failing to, to address, consideration of the borderline age situation, that the error was harmless because your client neglected to show evidence of additional adversities. What's your response to that contention?
Well, actually, that actually gets into the next part of the HALIS. The HALIS says that the claimant is basically, that the judge is supposed to look at the claimant's residual functional capacity combined with age, education, and work experience as examples of factors that the ALJ should consider. In this particular case, the claimant was found to be illiterate, which is the lowest category of education the person can have, and was found to have no work history at all whatsoever. Within the ranges of the GRIDs, there is, for instance, in her case, it would have gone from limited education, which would be ninth grade, all the way down to illiterate. She's down at the lower end of the range. That's a special factor. There's also the fact that she was actually had absolutely no work history whatsoever. In fact, there is a special vocational guideline that says that if a claimant is 55 years old, which she would have been in 2.5 months, has no more than a limited education, has no past relevant work, if she has simply one severe, any severe medically determinable impairment, she's to be found disabled. The regulation goes on to make clear that in such a case, they won't even assess residual functional capacity. They won't even look at the grades. Her case is considered to be so adverse, her unique circumstances of being no work history whatsoever, and in that, and having less than limited education or limited education or no more than that, that's defined as already a situation where she should automatically get disability without even having to prove residual functional capacity at age 55. The POMS 25015.006 actually gives an example of a case factor combination that would support using the higher age category. And it says 54 years and 6 months old. She was older than that, who has medium residual functional capacity, which she had, who has a fourth grade education, no past relevant work. She was found to have illiterate and no past relevant work, which is lower than that. That person should be considered for the borderline age according to the POMS. So it, as far as the harmless error goes, their own policy says that this is a classic case of a person who should be put in the higher age category. Please remember that the claimant in this case before the court was just, like I said, 2 months and 5 days away from being age 55. In the case before this court, the ALJ decision makes absolutely no reference to the fact that the claimant is a borderline age situation. The appellant asserts that this regulation, with its mandate that says we will consider whether to use the older age category in borderline situations, is mandatory. Now, in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, in the case of Schoeffel versus Commissioner, the court held that the ALJ had no discretion to ignore the command in the regulation, ordering the ALJ to consider whether to use the older age in borderline, and to ignore the command would never be harmless error. The Schofield Court also noted decisions from its sister courts, including the 8th, 10th, and 3rd circuits, supported their decision, and the 9th circuit said that the ALJ must show borderline situations that she considered whether to use the older age category. The claimant respectfully requests that this court join its sister circuits in supporting the same conclusion.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Ron.
We'll hear from Ms. Palacios Paredes.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, Catherine Palacios, on behalf of the appellant. I will be addressing the remaining issues that the appellant raised. First, with respect to new and material evidence, at issue here is whether the evidence submitted to the Appeals Council was new, material relating to the period at issue on or before the date of the hearing decision, and fourth, whether it showed a reasonable probability that the additional evidence would have changed the outcome of the decision. The commissioner appears to not contest the first three elements, but does note that there was no reasonable probability that the additional evidence would have changed the outcome, arguing that that element was absent. The commissioner first argues that the ALJ already expressly considered evidence of the claimant's stress incontinence, her diabetes, and related symptoms, and that she had complained of hip and back pain in assessing the claimant's claim and functioning. But for one, there is no standard requiring the claimant prove a never-before-considered impairment. Moreover, the judge's failure to find that the claimant's urinary incontinence was a severe impairment is problematic because, in part, the new evidence shows it was of such a severity as to necessitate surgery. The commissioner readily acknowledges that the claimant reporting having to use 5 pads a day, and these additional limitations relating to such an impairment could reasonably include reduced lifting and carrying weight.
She's had the surgery and that has improved. Is that correct?
It was after the period at issue that the ALJ addressed. So there may be even a closed period of disability, depending upon
This case is complicated because that particular condition was addressed and was ameliorated for better. It was successful surgery. So that would limit the disability timeframe to the extent it was caused by that particular issue. Is that correct?
I would reserve judgment on that. From our perspective, we don't have updated medical records for this case. You know, the medical record extends through the evidence that was submitted to the Appeals Council. We don't necessarily know that in the long term her surgery was successful to the extent that it would not give rise to any further limitations.
All right, well, let's try this. I thought, at least for right now, the surgery, when it was 2016, the condition that was causing the incontinence was ameliorated at least for that period of time. Is that wrong?
Perhaps, Your Honor, but we don't have evidence subsequent to that.
Counsel, let me ask you something related to that. When I was going through the notes, I noticed that there's an August 2nd, 2016 note that says that Ms. Pupo was told to take, quote, pelvic rest and no heavy lifting, unquote. It seems like maybe that wasn't considered by the agency, because the vocational expert actually included some lifting, I guess, that was substantial. I mean, it seems like, I don't know if you want to address that.
Well, yes, the ALJ in this case found in his residual functional capacity assessment finding that the claimant was capable of medium exertional work. Medium exertional work entails lifting and carrying up to 50 pounds. I mean, that is a significant amount of weight. And one could reasonably conclude that somebody with urinary incontinence, who herself complained that lifting and carrying a significant amount of weight induced accidents to occur, and medically there's a relationship between putting pressure on the upper body and the pelvic region, and one could reasonably conclude there's a relationship and that there would be limitations that arise from such an impairment. And the fact that the ALJ found that she could lift and carry 50 pounds, I mean, 50 pounds is, you know, 5 or 6 year old child, and it's 50 pounds for up to and including a third of the day. So that would be more than 2 hours out of a typical 8 hour workday, 5 days a week, you know, four weeks out of a month. That is a lot of weight to expect somebody with that particular impairment to lift and carry on such a regular and consistent basis. I see that I'm over my time, but I would be happy to continue to address any questions that the panel may have for me.
All right, thank you, counsel. We'll hear from Ms. Fischel on behalf of the commissioner.
Good morning, and may it please the court, Shannon Fischel on behalf of the commissioner. Turning first to the question of step
five. Okay, all right, the clock started, excuse me.
Oh, no problem. Turning first to the question of the step five finding, and I want to back up a bit to give a little context to what happens at step five. As you well know, it's an evaluation of a claimant's ability to perform other work in the national economy. But there are two main ways that the commissioner goes about meeting the burden at step five. And the first way involves the medical vocational guidelines, which we often call the GRIDs. Now, what the GRIDs involve are the using certain factors, the vocational factors, including age, education level, and past relevant work history, as well as the exertional elements of the residual functional capacity finding. The ALJ uses these and plugs it into a table matrix, and then there's a statutorily directed finding that results, and that finding may be disabled or not disabled. Now, this court has stated that when there is a borderline age situation and the GRIDs are being applied, the age factor cannot be applied mechanically within the GRIDs, and the claimant is to receive an opportunity to proffer evidence, and that evidence needs to show that the claimant has a lesser ability to adapt than her peers with regard to performing other work in the national economy. Now, the other way that the commissioner can meet the burden at step five is through the use of vocational expert testimony. And this is generally preferred because a vocational expert can give an individualized assessment based on all the factors involved in the claimant's case. And here, the ALJ relied on a vocational expert because there were non-exertional limitations in the residual functional capacity assessment related to
the vocational expert here was only about her psychological state. It was a psychologist. The RFC expert was a psychologist, I believe. And I was concerned that there was no vocational expert who evaluated her physical condition. Am I right on that?
So the vocational expert just evaluates the ability to perform other work in the national economy based on the residual functional capacity finding. Now, with respect to determining the residual functional capacity finding, I think you are correct. There was not a physical consultative examination that was performed, but there was extensive medical evidence in the record related to-
I know, but most all of these cases have a medical doctor who does the RFC as to physical ability. You had a PhD doctor do a locational evaluation because she's got depression and other mental health issues. And they did on that, but nobody did really the physical part, it seemed to me.
Well, I know
you say there's medical evidence and the ALJ can make it from the medical evidence. I got that part.
Correct. There's no requirement.
ALJ did it from the medical evidence.
Yes, the ALJ relied on the medical evidence and did not rely on a medical opinion specifically for assessing the physical residual functional capacity. But of course, the regulations do not require the ALJ to rely on.
I know, but isn't it true in most cases we have also a doctor opining and the commissioner puts in evidence from a doctor as to the RFC?
In some cases, but not in all. It's at the discretion of the ALJ. If the ALJ feels that the evidentiary record is incomplete and that a consultative examination would be useful in making the determination, then the ALJ can order that. So we do not see that in all cases. It does show up somewhat frequently, but again, that often shows up in cases where there is not substantial physical evidence in the record. And here we have several years of objective medical records.
So if you wanted to require that, how would you say that? Independent medical exam?
We typically refer to it as a physical consultative examination, is the typical language you see in the regulations.
Consultative examination to determine what?
To essentially evaluate her physical abilities with respect to functional limitations arising from her medical impairments.
Okay. Let me be candid with you. This ALJ did that RFC and he said she has the RFC to perform medium work, which we've already heard is up to 50 pounds.
Correct.
And it's a long time since I've seen somebody in this shape. They say medium work. You normally have light work. And he says medium work without even a medical doctor doing an RFC.
Well, respectfully, what we're looking for is substantial evidence. And as you well know, that is not a high standard. It's more than a scintilla, but it's no more than a reasonable mind would find is adequate to accept the conclusion. And here, the physical objective examination findings are consistently unremarkable, including she doesn't have any gait abnormalities. There are no neurological deficits. She shows full motor strength and range of motion in her extremities.
Yeah, I think you're right. His problem was that there was no objective medical evidence of any physical limitation.
And I would also point out that she received exceptionally conservative care. And the handful of times that she did complain of musculoskeletal pain or back pain, her doctor simply directed her to rest for a few days, use heat therapy and take over-the-counter medication as needed. This isn't one of those cases where we see extensive and significant treatment for complaints of back or musculoskeletal pain. And so I do think that in this particular case, there is substantial evidence as it exists in the record before the ALJ to support the finding for medium level work. I also think that substantial evidence supports the step 5 finding, which again was made.
But before you go, how do we know that the decision would be the same if the commissioner had considered the older age category?
Well, Your Honor, I think what it comes down to is that under the 11th Circuit precedent, claimant has the burden to show through an evidentiary proffer that she has a lesser ability to adapt than her peers. Now, this court held in Patterson v. Bowen that in making that proffer, the claimant cannot rely on evidence related to her education or her past work history or her residual functional capacity. Here, claimant points to two main items, which are her inability to speak English and her lack of past relevant work or past work history at all.
I guess what I'm trying to figure out is the regulations expressly state that if you are within a few days or months of reaching an older age category, it says the commissioner will consider whether to use the older age category, and the commissioner did not consider whether to use the older age category in this case. Did it? That's mandatory language.
Well, you are correct that there is no articulation in the decision, but those regulations also provide that the ALJ must consider this when using the higher age category would result in a finding of disability. And the place where that would occur is when the ALJ uses the grids, because the grids statutorily direct a finding. And here we have vocational expert testimony, which was an individualized assessment of claimant's abilities to perform other work based on not only her factors, her vocational factors in RFC, but also, you know, using the vocational expert's judgment and professional experience.
But that's not what the Fifth and the Third and the Eighth Circuits held.
Based on Schofield, it does appear that the Fifth Circuit implied that there is a requirement regardless of whether you're using the VE or the grids. But, you know, under 11th Circuit precedent, again, this would ultimately be harmless error, because even if the ALJ should have articulated whether or not the higher age category should have been used, claimant still had to show an inability to adapt or a lesser ability to adapt than her peers. And she cannot make that showing under this court's precedent, because she seeks to rely on information that was already before the ALJ and was already considered with respect to her vocational factors. And so even if this court determines that the ALJ was required to make this finding, sending this case back wouldn't result in a change, because her evidence is not the type of evidence that is required to make the showing of the inability or lesser ability to adapt. But again, you know, this court has addressed a remarkably similar situation in its unpublished decision of Miller versus Commissioner of Social Security at 241 Federal Appendix 631. And in addressing this question, this court has highlighted that it's simply theoretical in settings where a vocational expert testimony was used to establish the step five finding. And I would argue that, you know, this is in opposite of what Schoenfield suggests, and that under this court's precedent, that in fact the ALJ is not required to articulate a finding regarding a borderline age situation when relying on the vocational expert testimony. And again, this is supported by the language of the regulations, which require the ALJ to make this finding when ultimately applying the older age category would direct a finding of disabled. So in this case, we have vocational expert testimony given in response to an accurate hypothetical question, and that amounts to substantial evidence in support of the step five finding. Now, turning to the question of the additional evidence that claimant submitted to the appeals council, as found, as argued in the brief, this simply doesn't allow for a reasonable possibility that there would be a different outcome. And I know that she emphasizes her urinary incontinence, but I would point out that during the hearing before the ALJ, when she was asked the reasons why she was unable to work, she did not mention urinary incontinence or trouble with that situation. What she mentioned was constipation and discomfort that came from that, which is remarkably different from urinary incontinence. And while it's true that there was some evidence before the ALJ regarding her complaints of this condition, you know, the ALJ acknowledged that evidence, but frankly, there was no objective findings or no particular statements by claimant that suggested this was a disabling condition.
Counsel?
Yes.
What about the August 2nd, 2016 record from her hospital visit, where it says she was told to take pelvic rest and have no heavy lifting?
Well, with respect to that single record, that in and of itself does not suggest there is a lack of substantial evidence for the ALJ's finding, in particular because it may show that she had exacerbated symptoms on that one occasion, but there's nothing throughout the record showing that she was receiving that type of guidance or directives At earlier periods of time. And in fact, it appears that at earlier periods of time, she elected to proceed with very conservative care and treatment, which mostly appeared to involve exercising pelvic floor muscles to strengthen and support the bladder. She did not seek the surgical correction until much, much later. So there's just nothing in the record before the ALJ to support significant limitations of function related to—
But what about as of that time?
As of that time, potentially, but again, we have a single record with this directive in it, and then she subsequently has corrective surgery, which I'm assuming was successful. Perhaps it was not. We don't have those records. But so it would be a very, very limited period. And remember, there's a durational requirement. She would need to show that this condition lasted 12 months or longer, and that this condition rendered her disabled for that 12-month period. So I do not believe that that record, or even beginning if we look at that period of time to the point of surgery, would be sufficient to establish that durational requirement for purposes of the disability finding. With respect to the other evidence that was submitted to the Appeals Council, it consisted mostly of similar records that were before the ALJ, a continuation of her mental health treatment and a continuation of her treatment by Dr. Diaz. And then there was also, I believe, a prescription for orthotics and a single document notating diabetic neuropathy. But throughout the period of time before the ALJ, there was no treatment for diabetic neuropathy, and there were no abnormal neurological findings. There are several documented treatment findings in the record where she had fully normal monofilament foot examinations indicating that she wasn't experiencing diabetic neuropathy symptoms at that point. And so again, that evidence is just not sufficient to undermine substantial evidence in support of the ALJ's finding, and thus doesn't warrant a remand for further consideration. So as this court well knows, this case is governed by the substantial evidence issue or standard, which really does not present a high bar. We know it's more than in Sotilla, but it's not even a preponderance. It's really no more than such relevant evidence as a reasonable mind might accept as adequate to support the ALJ's conclusion. And here, I think in the very thorough decision by the ALJ, which discusses these treatment records at length and acknowledges both favorable and less favorable findings by the doctors, the ALJ readily satisfied the substantial evidence standard. And because the ALJ also properly complied with the regulations, I respectfully ask this court to affirm the decision. So if the panel has no further questions, I will rest on the commissioner's brief. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Fischel. We'll hear from Mr. Tablicki.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I just want to toss out real quickly, in case it was missed, there is actually a physical residual functional capacity form filled out by the claimant's treating doctor, which had her at way below sedentary, which the ALJ rejected completely. I just want to, and that's at Exhibit 33.
I'm aware that he said he's discounted all that because there's no objective findings. But normally the government has their own expert in these cases, and they don't hear. The ALJ just made the findings himself. But maybe I'm wrong about this.
You're correct, Your Honor. Okay. And now regarding
RFC by a medical doctor, the ALJ made the findings based on the overall medical record and then discounted the medical doctors.
Exactly. He interpreted the raw evidence himself, which he really isn't supposed to do because he's not a doctor. Addressing her issue about the Patterson versus Commissioner case, at first it should be noted the claimant actually won that case. Regarding her assertion that evidence concerning the claimant's education, work experience, residual functional capacity don't relate to the question of whether the claimant's ability to adapt to new work environment is at the level required of the GRIDS, which is actually stated a bit contradicting in the Patterson case, that's actually the polar opposite of what's required under the policy manual of the HALIS, which it specifically lists as the only examples that it gives that should be considered as age, education, work experience, and residual functional capacity. Once again, that's HALEX I2-242C. According to the government's position, if the ALJ follows the HALEX, then he's in violation of Patterson. And if the ALJ follows Patterson, he's in violation of the HALEX. In the Patterson case, the Patterson wrote that in this case, the claimant had carpal tunnel syndrome, has significantly limited her manual dexterity and grip strength in her hand, and this is new evidence that would create a difficulty in adapting to the new situation. But then basically it went into the footnote and said, of course, evidence that is relevant to a claimant's residual functional capacity may also be relevant to the question of whether the claimant's ability to adapt to a new environment is less than the level presumed. He said over here, for instance, in the instant case, in the Patterson case, the left carpal tunnel syndrome was related to the ability to lift, but then also dexterity. Now, if the commissioner is looking for another additional factor that's outside of those, well, we have the urinary incontinence. That's an additional factor. If for no other reason, the appeals counsel should have sent it back to find out if that would have made a difference on the borderline age situation.
Can I ask you about the RFC that her doctor did? He said she could do sedentary work?
No. He said that she was below sedentary, which meant she could do no work at all whatsoever on a continuous basis, which would have been an automatic finding of disability for any claimant.
I have one other question on page 18 of the 19-page ALJ order. He does refer to that she was born in 1961, is 49. And he does say the claimant subsequently changed age category to closely approaching advanced age and cites that CFR 416963.
Yes, Your Honor.
Borderline age.
Right. No, actually, what
he does acknowledge it. He doesn't then seem to apply it, but he does acknowledge it.
And actually, no, Your Honor. In that particular case, he's talking about that the claimant was at 49 and then changed to 50. He wasn't acknowledging that at this point she was 54 and 10 months and was about to go to 55. He was acknowledging.
I see.
He completely ignored that she was going to be 55 in the decision.
Well, what at this when's the day of this decision? Was she about to be 50 to 55, or she was going?
She was
2017.
She was exactly 2 months and 5 days away from turning 55. It should be noted, by the way, that she
on the date of this decision.
Yes, on the date of the decision, she was 2 months and 5 days away from the age of 55. Which, according to the POMS, says that if for someone with a higher education, fourth grade, and who's 6 months away, that should be a case that should be considered for the borderline age situation.
In Schofield versus Saul, how far away was the claimant in that case away from 55 years of age?
I'm not exactly sure. I know it was less than 6 months. If I'm correct, but I don't know exactly how it would have been within the borderline age situation, I imagine, which would have been 6 months or less, which is the borderline age situation that Social Security is considering.
Well, at the time of this decision, she was 50. You're saying she was a few months away from 55.
She was 2 months and 5 days away exactly from being 55.
Okay, but isn't that what he's saying? She was 49 when the application was filed, and he's saying she subsequently changed age category to closely advancing.
Right, the age category.
But that would be 50 to 55. Why?
50 to 54. 55 would be advanced age. So what he's saying is that she applied and then she became closely approaching advanced age. So he's treating her as somebody closely approaching advanced age. He ignores the fact that she now is about to turn 55 and will actually be advanced age.
And the CFR for that is what?
That's the same 416.963. Which is the one that has the borderline age situation.
Yeah, so I don't know if that's accurate because he is saying she's closely approaching it, but that must mean she's...
I'm sorry, Your Honor. He actually writes on there, she was 18 to 49 on the date of application, and then she subsequently changed categories to closely approaching advanced age, which would be the 50 age group. He's acknowledging that she's no longer 18 to 49, and acknowledging that now she is in the 50 to 54 age range. He never goes beyond that to discuss any possibility of her being of the advanced age.
I mean, he doesn't say, and in the 50 to 55, she's now close to 55, is what you're saying.
Exactly, 50 to 54. He says that basically he says she's in the 50 to 54 and never acknowledges that now she's gonna be almost 55. He never ever acknowledges that in any way whatsoever. And it's really all the extra language with the commissioner says that it's only the regulation says that it should only be in cases where it's clear where the borderline is going to apply. None of that is there, actually. The statute of the regulation is very, very clear. If it's a borderline age situation, the AOJ will consider whether or not to apply the older age category. It's a mandatory language. There's no.
Now, have you filed a new application? Is there a new one pending? Because she has had progression here.
I mean,
problem in this case is this has started a long time ago and a lot has happened.
I mean, to be honest, Your Honor, she already filed again and was approved, immediately, because, it was such a clear cut case, but she was approved from the new application going forward. We still have to deal
with it. I thought with her age now, she probably would be able to qualify with everything.
Exactly. What
date is she getting it from?
I'm not exactly sure, but she would have gotten it automatically using the special vocational category, which says that she doesn't even have to have a residual functional capacity evaluation.
Well, what's the date she filed that application? She probably got it from that date.
She got it from the day that she filed. It would have been after she turned 55. I don't know the exact date. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I don't have that.
That's okay.
To Blakey, aren't we going beyond the record in this case? Aren't we bound by these issues in our record?
Yes, Your Honor. I was just answering the judge's question, Your Honor, but she asked.
I agree that's not.
She was curious and I knew the answer, Your Honor, so I gave it to her.
Well, he was arguing about the age category and I just wanted to file a new application based on the age category because she's now over 55.
Yeah. I'm over my time, if there's any additional questions, I'll be happy to answer them. If not, then I would like possible Catherine Palacios could have whatever she wants to do for rebuttal.
She has 5 minutes. She already has 5 minutes.
Ms. Palacios?
Yes, Judge, thank you. a couple of items that I just wanted to briefly address. Ms. Fischel notes that the factors of age, education, and past work cannot be looked at to assess whether there is an additional adverse factor. And yet the agency's own policy states in POMS that there are examples of factors that may impact the case. This subsection provides examples of case factor combinations that could support the use of a higher age category in a borderline age situation. Example number 3 provided by the agency states where the claimant is 54 years and 6 months old, has a medium RFC, fourth grade education, and no past relevant work. That example is given by the agency relying on age, education, and RFC as factors and past work as the combination of factors that could support the use of a higher age category. And I think the point that we are trying to impress here is that there is absolutely no indication in the ALJ's decision that he even considered the borderline factor in the first place. And whether the claimant had the opportunity to proffer these additional factors is still yet to be seen. I have 30 seconds left, so I'll address one more thing briefly. Ms. Fischel was arguing that the evidence does not support a determination that she was any more limited, that the claimant was any more limited than a medium RFC, but we have objective evidence on record. For example, x-rays confirmed a history of cervical degenerative spondylosis at multiple levels. X-rays of the thoracic spine revealed multi-level degenerative spondylosis. The record documents the claimant's impairments included back pain with left leg radiation, lumbago, obesity, hypertension, the type 2 diabetes with the neuropathy, the uterine prolapse. She suffered from a comminuted fracture of the mid-left clavicle when she was hit by a pickup truck. She also had moderate lipping and spurring at C4 levels and C6 levels with diminished space in the cervical spine. There are a multitude of findings that appellant outlines in the briefing, and I'll just wrap this up very quickly, that support her allegations that she is more limited than a full medium lifting and carrying 50 pounds a third of the day, a third of the work week, RFC would support. And the judge ultimately discounting the opinion of her treating source without good cause under the old regulations is also a violation of that. And they're very much related issues, but as a package, as a whole, if we find reason to believe that the RFC is not supported by the record, that greater weight should have been given to the treating source opinion, then the whole idea that she could even perform at that level of work on a sustained basis goes out the window. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Palacios and Mr. Teplicki and Ms. Fischel. And that concludes our docket for this week, and this court is adjourned.